This is Scott Becker with the Becker Private Equity and Business Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by one of the leaders of the private equity work at RSM, Matt Wolf. And in such an interesting time, we're seeing a little bit of the froth come off the market, concerns about Omicron, depending on how you pronounce it. We're seeing the Fed get a little bit more aggressive in fighting inflation. Riskier assets are struggling a little bit as people move more towards safety. We're going to talk to Matt a little bit today about what trends he's watching and also about himself and RSM. Matt, take a moment and tell us about yourself and RSM. Now let's talk about the trends you're watching currently in the private equity world.
Happy to. Thanks, Scott. I've been at RSM working with our private equity practice, mostly in the healthcare area. Now I came from a financial service background, corporate finance background, and you know, I just love this industry and the area that we work in so much. Every day we get to learn something new. It feels like I sharpen my mind every day, whether it's conversations with you or with our clients. It's just a really exciting environment to be in that absolutely captivated me, and you know, helped us to build out a team that we get to serve some really exciting clients and get front seats to some very exciting and transformative deals. And that's kind of, I guess, what's really enticed me about this field and kept me at RSM now for 12 years and decades to come, I suppose.
And talk for a moment about, you're this crazily talented person, incredible perspective on things. Talk a little bit about RSM and how it's built its private equity practice over the years, because it's become like sort of almost an undisputed leader in the middle market private equity, quality of earnings, diligence, sell side work, buy side work. The whole business has really done a great job of building this great practice. Talk a bit about RSM.
Happy to, yeah. I mean, it's really about being very client-centric, right? And recognizing that different clients want to be served in different ways. And, you know, at RSM, we have great practices that serve companies that are not-for-profit or are not sponsor-backed or are public. And all of those different groups and executives, they want to be served in a different way. And with private equity groups and their portfolio companies, you know, there's kind of a general way in which they want to be served. You know, we're very responsive. We strive and hustle hard every day to bring leading industry and other operational insights. And really, we focus a lot on just sharing our perspective, right? So I work with all of our private equity relationships, but I focus on healthcare. That's the work that I do. And so being able to have conversations and say, well, I know you're, you know, rolling up this dental services organization. Here's what you're seeing compared to the five or six others that I also work with and am plugged into, and being able to share some of that perspective in a very confidential way, but just kind of bringing that insight and those trends to help all of our clients be better investors, better executives, better operators is something we really focus on and pride ourselves on.
Thank you. And talk about currently, what are the trends you're watching in the private equity space? What are you watching currently?
Well, you alluded to one earlier, which is this very abrupt shift in Powell's comments earlier this week as of this recording with respect to their approach to monetary policy and their views on inflation, and thinking that, you know, retiring the term transitory, suggesting that it was kind of misinterpreted by the markets, and now we see money markets pricing in, you know, perhaps a 60 basis point increase or rate hike next year, perhaps even as early as the first half of next year, and trying to combat some of this inflation, trying to understand, you know, what does that mean for the deal environment? And then, of course, Omicron, and what does that mean? And that is just uncertain. There's a lot of, you know, we're still waiting to see what does that mean for booster efficacy? What does that mean for social distancing requirements that might put a further hamper on global trade or the economy, and then also just watching watching shipping still and transportation and logistics. And we've seen some of the slack return there a little bit in some areas. We're really kind of looking at the pipes of the actual real economy. What does that mean for the deal environment? Those are probably the top three things that we're watching right now.
When you look at Powell's comments, he had been in this weird spot where Biden had been pushed by the left to interview somebody else as a potential chairperson of the Fed board. And now Biden made the decision that he's falling forward. Is there any piece of that that's led him to be a little clearer on what he sees with inflation? Because this inflation thing feels like a real thing to very many of us. There are pieces of it that feel transitory. There's pieces of it that don't. But he obviously doesn't want to be accused of having fueled a huge bubble in assets. Is there a political piece to this, or is this really just his clarifying his view of what he has to do?
Yeah, I worry that there was a political element to it. I mean, it's occurring in Washington, D.C. You can't escape the politics of it. You know, I think that the Fed has been pretty clear from day one that, you know, monetary policy is going to be limited in its efficacy in terms of how it can deal with some of the inflation. Now, one thing that I think the Fed can do is, you know, if we, as they indicated, they're going to kind of reduce their asset purchases even faster, right? They're going to taper even faster. And I think on the housing market, whether it's, you know, apartment rentals or single family homes, whatever, as the asset purchases of mortgage-backed securities, as that declines and rates for those securities increase, that will dampen some of the market activity that we've seen and some of this rush of people to get that bigger mortgage, buy that bigger house, buy that bigger condo. And that's been a real driver of inflation. Owner's equivalent rent has really, it's a big part of that 6.2% print that we all saw, right? And so, you know, the interest rate, the federal funds target rate is one part of that, but the asset purchasing, you know, slowing that down, I think could have a pretty noticeable effect on rents and the housing market and therefore on those inflation prints.
It's a fascinating perspective because some of those purchases are just U.S. Treasury bond purchases, but then a good deal of them are mortgage bond purchases, and that artificially keeps the mortgage bond market and yields low. If those go up, that will have an impact on housing prices because so many people still buy their houses with mortgages, of course. Any uptick in mortgage rates means your real carrying cost of a house goes up. Fascinating perspective. It really is interesting. So we talked about some of these trends, Omicron, the Fed's comments, and there's also this discussion. I mean, to those of us that are traditionalists, and I hate to date myself, I'm feeling so vintage, we view the concept as government debt as ultimately anathema. And there has been this political issue, this concept that another $1.8 trillion in spending, another $2 trillion in spending won't cause the country to be more fragile, won't cause us to be more indebted and so forth, that we'll try and pay for it in different ways. But what's the perspective on the market? Do people worry about that stuff, or is that just sort of like we've gotten so immune to these discussions of in what seem like insane amounts of debt as a nation that people are no longer that, you know, worried about it? Or what is the sense of that?
I don't get the sense that most macro strategists and investors are concerned about the increasing debt and the balance sheet of the United States today for a couple reasons. Number one is the investment, at least on the infrastructure bill, I think generally people view as good policy, right? Regardless of the politics, these are investments in public goods that will increase efficiency and increase opportunities for wealth creation for everybody. And then second, you know, we are as a country in a very unique situation that we can essentially print the world's reserve currency. So to some degree, the deficits and the debt, you know, we're pretty far away from danger level, danger territory. It absolutely matters. It is important, but we're pretty far away from a level where it would be dangerous. You know, we can't compare ourselves in that respect to Japan or other countries that just don't have the luxury of being able to print the world's reserve currency.
And so what you see is for so many of our nation, it's in the private equity professionals. When you look at private equity professionals, they largely want to see things keep on going, keep on moving in the right direction, because everybody's making money. They're investing in deals. As long as they can invest, hopefully improve those deals a little bit, flip them within a few years, everybody feels like a winner. And so they'd like it. I mean, on the street, you have that, oh my goodness, you have some people that would be concerned about long-term economically, but if you're truly a private equity professional, this has been a magnificent, fun economic time to be in the business, hasn't it?
Absolutely. A lot of opportunities for investment, public partner, private, public-private partnerships, and even just kind of the externalities that these public goods will create. You know, I think that there is a misconception amongst the media, and we talk about infrastructure projects as being, you know, we're going to invest in shovel-ready projects. And I think in general, that doesn't really exist, right? I mean, it's going to be a long process to make these investments to build out that infrastructure. And it's going to require, you know, private companies to participate in that. And there will be benefits and opportunities there as well, right? The rising tide lifts all boats.
Right. It certainly is the kind of situation where nothing's truly shovel ready. It's not like the FDR times where you just put people to work on the street cleaning stuff up. And even if we wanted to, we couldn't do that anyways, because people are all quite frankly employed largely. We've got unemployment down to 4.5% or so. And generally, there's a ton of jobs unfilled. So even if you wanted to throw out money, it'd be hard to do. So, right, the concept of shovel ready, it is a process, isn't it? That may take a couple of administrations for 2022 to really get going. What a fascinating time. What else are you watching in the private equity world right now? I take it that the firm is still insanely busy, very busy. Deal flow, it's basically you can't take on more deals before the end of the year. What else are you seeing out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think every conversation that I have with, you know, operating partners, deal partners at the firms themselves or their executive teams, I don't have a conversation that doesn't include labor, the labor market. And we're really seeing a conscious effort of portfolio companies, these executive teams, these operating partners, looking at new ways to structure and think about compensation. How do we, you know, make sure we can attract and retain the right mix of talent, which, you know, has always been an issue, especially at that executive team level for most portfolio companies. But I think they're really looking at it as a priority, a way to, they got to think about in terms of their strategy in a way that we just haven't seen historically. So we're all kind of figuring this out together, trying different strategies, seeing what works, what doesn't work, and evolving in that way to deal with this labor market that I think is going to be pretty persistent for the next several years, at least.
It sure seems like, and it does seem that, you know, it certainly also seems like a somewhat mismatched labor market. We need more and more people, again, in the trades and stuff. We don't have them. We need more and more people in nursing and doctoring, and there's limits on that, from just artificial limits through both med schools and more important residencies. So there's all kinds of these built-in constraints that we have that seem like some of them are long-term constraints.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, you mentioned the medical field exactly. I was talking to a large veterinary group the other day and talking about this and realizing, well, it takes 12 years to train a new vet, right? So what are we going to do to attract the ones that exist already? And that's a zero-sum game. How do we use technology to augment the people that we can hire and retain so that they're able to of the important work that only humans can do. How do we use technology to do the work that computers can do to free up, you know, and they're very important conversations. The other stat I'll throw out here is dissipation rate. We're probably, depending on the estimate you want to look at of where we should be, we're still probably missing about 6 to 8 million people from the workforce. And if you look at the age of that workforce and kind of impute early retirements, we've probably had about 3.25 million people retire early in that sort of 55 and age up bracket. These are generally workers who, you know, faced with the stress pandemic, looked at their financial situation and said, you know what, I can just be done. And they're done. And so that's a huge chunk of very experienced, very valuable employees that have just left the workforce. And it will take a long time to replace those skills and talents.
And I'd seen that number this morning, more the 3 million number that the workforce is just permanently out of for the time being, and trying to look at how does that, what does that mean for the long term in terms of so forth. Let me ask you another question that's near and dear to people in the private equity business. One of the things I've heard recently, and this goes to the private jet class, is that there is not enough private jet pilots. And so thus, some of our colleagues in private equity may have a challenge chartering or getting into the flight programs they'd like to for private flying. Where is the level of empathy for that in the general community, do you sense?
I don't think it's high, but it speaks to your earlier point that, you know, there's a lot of work that is being automated as we can't find people. You know, we still need pilots, right? It's a skilled trade that pays well, and if, you know, people are looking to make a career decision or a career change, you know, a good opportunity for folks, certainly.
But it really is amazing how there are these built-in shortages of things. The people that went into that area, you know, X 10, 20, 30 years ago are starting to retire. There's just not enough people as flying picks back up. And you see this in staffing planes, staffing everything. It's really a fascinating situation to see the economy that's worked so well through sort of in so many ways, it now seems a little discombobulated as things are just mismatched in terms of where labor is, talent is, issues are, and so forth. It's really, and certainly not an argument for a managed economy. I'm the biggest fan against that. But it is fascinating to see a period of time where we're seeing some of these adjustments and disruptions that we've not really seen in our lifetimes. It's really a fascinating thing to watch. Anyway, Matt, I share with you the concept that I think the private jet flying class doesn't get that much sympathy from the rest of the world. Clearly the case. But in any event, Matt, a pleasure visiting with you again today. I've taken more of your time than I planned to. I appreciate you joining us. What a great guest. Matt Wolf, RSM. RSM is the leader, sort of the middle market private equity world, just a magnificent practice. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott. My pleasure.